lives are pretty great.
Outstanding.
Here they are.
Happy birthday.
How did you know it was my birthday?
The best!
Now, where are we off to?
Are you planning another holiday?
You know what I was doing at your age?
The Lombardo. Listening to Wham. Dating a girl with shoulder pads.
That's enough.
Congratulations on the film. It's a fantastic film. I really enjoyed it.
When did you see it?
I saw it on Monday night.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
So yeah. I was lucky.
With a big audience or something?
Yeah, it was with a large audience.
Yeah,
actually.
It was good. Because the comedies are made to be seen with an audience.
And this is the thing. I mean, when I was speaking to Daniel and Jody this morning, and they were saying that one of the things that both attracted them to working with you was that, well, one, the Working Dog name, and two, the chance at trying out comedy in that environment. And I guess when you come to a story like this, which is sort of a mixture between a comedy but also that real pathos as well, what was it that was a spark for you in writing the story?
Because I kind of think if you literally make it just comedy, because somewhere around about the 45-minute mark, it becomes inconsequential.
Mm.
You've got to somehow, you know, that's why I end up, comedies love a great character.
Mm.
You know, Kenny or Crocodile Dundee,
yeah,
or even Daryl Kerrigan, oddly enough, you know, it was a family, but you realise he's a big character. It's a character that carries you. You actually need to know what happens to a big, you know, when I say big, I don't mean hamming characters. I mean, you know, you go, wow, you just, you get hypnotised into wanting to see what happens to them. And I think comedies, that's, but this is an ensemble.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, you can't just make it a series of misunderstandings and mishaps. You know, there's got to be something. Your audience has to know you're heading somewhere.
Yeah.
And not that we're heading anywhere, somewhere didactic. We're just saying, look at this guy. It's logical that in the end, when he flips out and he realises. Well, we're saying, you know, there's a manifest difference between being in your mid-20s now than 20, definitely 30 years ago.
Mm.
You know, the world is your oyster. You know, people, you're kind of a global, if you want to be, you're a global citizen. Mm. You might find yourself working in Berlin as much as you'll work down the Bondi. Yeah.
Mm.
And the world's populated by these roving tribes of people. You know, they travel a lot, Africa, lots of relationships and all of this. And then we knew of the concept of the midlife crisis, at the quarter life crisis.
Mm.
So we thought, what a great clash, you know. But if you pick a person with the perfect lifestyle, it's hard to derail it.
Yeah.
Lose a job, he just gets another one.
Yeah.
And then one day we sort of had a bolt of lightning and we went, school.
Mm.
You know, you go back to school and you're not cool.
Yeah.
You've wasted 10 years. Mm. You know, or you think, what's gone on? What? What do you mean?
Mm.
Surely I'm cooler than I, you know. And then, you know, and then he goes, well, you know, like the headmaster says, he goes, I got the order wrong. And I go, that doesn't help him either. And you think, you get the order wrong. You don't put a person working in humanitarian United Nations. And go, you know, tell us about vodka. It's like he's dead at that point. So, it's not a clear answer. And you know, and so, but it does. School would just, it's good, you know, at the 10-year mark, if you turned up triumphant and it went badly, it would throw him. And it throws him just enough, you know.
And yeah, I was going to ask you that because it is a really difficult thing to have a character that is, I guess, successful and he's dating another woman every night and he's got the cars. You know, did you ever feel at all in that process? Did you worry that people were going to not relate?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a worry, but you've got to be a bit truthful.
Yeah,
you know, you can't say really he's got a heart of gold deep down. No, he doesn't. He's a selfish, great guy and great company, and the girl's going to the relationship thing, this is going to be great, and he just doesn't mean it.
Mm.
But he's, you know, he's got a great friendship group, and he's, you know, ready. And then he gets thrown, and then, you know, funny enough, the tennis player is based on a true story I know, and I thought that's another great derailment because she's more global than him and is ready to move on quicker than him, and he's going, whoa, hang on. Mm. So I just wanted a taste of his own medicine. And that throws him again, and so yeah, so it's all like that. But one of the observations that I think it's under remarked upon is that a lot of the big things in life that used to be in your 20s, choosing to get married, well, until recently, having kids in your 20s was standard. People now instinctively, I reckon if you did a poll of people living in inner city, they've penciled that in for their 30s.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So you've got at least 10 clean years.
Mm.
That's fine, you know, your job and your career and your education and all these sort of things and travel. But when you get into a pretty serious relationship, both people are sitting there going, our timing's wrong. And it's a weird thing. We're probably not going to. We might go out for years, but we're not going to end up together. Yeah, there's a fair chance.
Yeah.
And so that timing, that's a funny, you know, to have a series of relationships knowing that they're not going to last is, even though you don't go into it saying that, it's a funny. So what? So there's a timing issue coming up.
And,
you know, maybe 50 years ago, the first serious relationship you had, you go, that's when you get married.
Yeah.
Whereas now, people have lots of serious relationships.
Mm.
That's it. And then you've got to somehow navigate your way out of that mindset and go, no, now I actually have to choose. And I think that's a very interesting phenomenon.
It's interesting you mentioned the choice. I remember reading something recently about saying that the fact that we have choice now, we have more choice now, is making us miserable.
There's an interesting psychological school of thought now that truly is examining the choice makes you less happy and more depressed.
Yeah.
The guy wrote a book about it because about the breakfast cereal. He realised one day that there used to be one form of it.
And he was happy with that.
And he's happy with that. And then he became unhappy because he goes, maybe I should have got it with Honey Crunch, or maybe I'm having a lesser version of it. Maybe I'd enjoy myself more if I got it with the extra fiber.
It ruins your whole day. Oh, it's spoiled.
Yeah. And so what happens is we, with more choice, we grieve for the choices.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's in, you know, it's one of the things of the film is you have to give up to grow up. You know, that, you know, choice is sometimes an illusion.
Mm.
That you can only pick one thing.
And well, the subject of choice was Josh Lawson, always the
We said to Josh, we thought he was particularly talented. We first met him through Thank God You're Here. People said we were looking for people who could, we just had fast, sharp brains and were funny. And someone said, oh, you got to see Josh Lawson. And he really hadn't done anything, but well, we met him. He was just, you know, I think probably the most naturally gifted kind of comic person that could do comic material that we'd met. And so, and he just continued to amaze us. And then we thought, we made a note to ourselves that the next movie we made, we'd write with the lead actor in mind from a very early stage, so that all the little cadences were written for someone that we knew would do it this way or that way. And so we did. After maybe only two drafts, we got Josh. He was in Australia, and we said, "Come and read it." And you know, it won't be ready, but we just want to hear your voice in it. And so then we went off and did, you know, 10 more. And so he was in from quite an early stage. Because he's in every scene, so you know, it has to be him. You never feel like he's actually reading a script. It's got to be his thoughts. So it has to just come out of him. And so we started that very early.
Mm.
And then Rachel, I'd suggested Rachel very early. And she was away from between movies and came in, and so it was, that part was pretty easy. And then Dan was, I didn't know Dan, but Jane Kennedy was doing the casting, and he'd actually just started doing Snowtown, so it was funny, you know, because the part is a really loving and warm, he's currently playing a serial killer. So, and then Felicity had never done a film, so, but we'd seen her do a few comic things and thought, you know, she's made for it. So that, but it was fun casting in that age group, you know, because it's just, I don't know, cumulatively it just added a whole bunch of energy. It was really good.
When you've got a large ensemble cast like that, do you tend to, how tightly scripted is the film?
It's very tightly scripted. Yeah. It really is. That's the only thing I insist on. It's like a musical score.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you just do it that way.
Mm.
But that's why you need to, you know, you need people who can do it.
Mm.
I mean, there's always script issues. That doesn't flow out of that. We love you know, if you've identified a flaw, we'd love rewriting it. And during rehearsal, we, you know, Tom Gleiser would sit there, you know, ready, and we go, okay, swap that word, you know. The only thing was at the end of scenes, we'd give anyone, mostly Josh, a license to add something.
Yeah.
Just maybe to keep his brain alive. But a lot of, you know, maybe a dozen of those little things make it into the film.
Mm.
But he would always do it syllable for syllable.
Mm.
And then once it was over, he'd flick something in at the end. But,
yeah. Yeah, and I guess the other major character in the film is Melbourne, I guess.
Yeah.
Was it important for you to have it as a Melbourne-based thing?
No, it was important that we knew the town where we were going to base it. So, you know, if I lived here, I'd set it here.
Yeah.
But there's little nuances to a city that you...
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you don't know a city, you'll end up looking like the postcards for the city.
Yeah.
And it's a different place. In fact, we were about to shoot in one laneway and people said, because the Melbourne Tourism Board is shooting there tomorrow. We went, kill the location.
Yeah.
We're too late.
Mm.
And it was a lovely area, but it was probably too neat.
Yeah.
As in, we'll get sprung there. But it's things like, you know, major events are, that's what people do.
Yeah.
But it was complications because you've got to go to the tennis and shoot there. You know, it's only on 2 weeks a year.
Mm.
So that's difficult. You know, there's probably no one at that age that doesn't attend the VRC Spring Carnival one day in those 4 days.
Mm.
So you know, that's a rhythm of life.
Yeah.
So we knew all that. We knew, you know, there's a time in Melbourne where you just walk around and people walk around in big hats all over the city, going to the train station to go to this. And so there's those little rhythms in the city, if you understand them well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is in other cities, but... So, and also, too, Melbourne's changed in the last 20 years massively, because there's a policy to get people back living in the city.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the government probably thought they were going to get sort of retired couples.
Mm-hmm.
But young people move back in and, you know, revamped the city in a really exciting way.
Absolutely.
It's really changed. It's become a sort of a... I was talking to the Lord Mayor about this the other day. I ran into him down the street. And I asked him, I said, do you get lots of inquiries from overseas? He gets all the time.
Mm.
Because it's become a... You know, the least interesting part of Melbourne ended up being the indispensable part.
Mm.
And that was all these laneways, which really had rubbish, you know, skips in them. Low rents, and you know the creative kids come in and reinvent it, and suddenly, you know, the high rent strips look dated, and everyone was off in these little lanes, and so it's become a sort of a worldwide, you know, it's a poster child for it's redeveloping, you know, inner urban.
Yeah.
There's a lot of urban areas in the world have been hollowed out. People don't. And so it's sort of, you know, whether the lessons they're learning from it are the right ones, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it is funny. You go into Melbourne on the right night and it's...
Absolutely.
There's a buzz that is quite addictive. You can see why. But I would go into the city and just walk around and stalk it and try to get the... Why? When are those moments when it feels like that, and when does it not feel like that?
Mm.
Sometimes it doesn't feel buzzy at all.
Mm.
It feels very, very dull. And it's little things I noticed, that some nights there's no cleaners, or the lights in all the buildings are not on, and it's like Melbourne's asleep. And others, everything's going on, and then you realise that, you know, 1,000 taxis in the city have all got headlights on, and it makes.
Mm.
It's not enough cars in the city, it doesn't buzz. And sort of that was funny because I couldn't. It took me a while to work out when to shoot and how to shoot, and it was slowly, like a little Rubik's cube, would work out little bits and pieces. When is it magical? When is it not? There's a time of night at the comedy festival when there's queues around the town hall. But if the queues are gone, you remember the night when it's just full of people. So you have to sort of capture what your mind is remembering, not what you find. You have to plan it so that you come at the time when it looks like what your memory is.
Mm. And I guess the other side of that is, I mean, that was a city you're very familiar with in this film. You do travel a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know Queenstown pretty well, and Queenstown is, again, it's like, you know, it's a great city.
Yeah.
I've never been in the ski season. I only took to shoot this.
Yeah.
But I know, you know, all that heli-skiing and all that world, and it was interesting to see the guys that had never not been there. Josh and Christian hadn't been there.
Right.
And just everyone was blown away by it. It's just that feeling that, you know, it's a great holiday. And we needed a place where he'd go, because he'll delay it. But he goes there, and against this magnificent backdrop, he starts obsessing over his choice.
Yeah.
You know, grieving for the choice that he made.
Exactly.
So then we had to go to Yemen. So
I was going to say, yeah, was it important for you to, I mean, not cheat that thing and actually go to those locations?
We couldn't cheat that.
Yeah.
We tried to. No, for security reasons, but Morocco didn't look like Yemen. And the reason we didn't pick Morocco, because everyone's been to Morocco. Right? But, you know, this feels like it.
Yeah.
And so we had to pick a country that you would say, there you go, no one's been there. It sounds very exotic. But it's got a big diplomatic core of UN and American government and all that. You know, all those countries have, in their capital, have big diplomatic corps. It's all Southeast Asian countries have big expat communities. Not so much Yemen, but, and so then we've had to go there. So the warnings were getting worse and worse and worse. And then we just had to bite the bullet.
Mm-hmm.
We got a security expert who advised us and came with us.
That post-credit scene wasn't personal experience, was it?
No, funnily enough, life imitated art. When Josh came back, he was pulled. He was queried, why did you go to Yemen? Why did you? It was pretty bizarre.
Yeah.
I didn't know. They didn't even think of it. But so he was queried over what was your purpose to travel to you.
Mm-hmm.
But we, you know, you say, oh, to make a film, and you got photos on your iPhone. Though, oh really? You know, there's no way there. People are more interested than suspicious, I think.
Yeah, and I guess just finally, it might be too early to say, given you're still on the tour for this. But what plans do you have coming up for the near future?
I wouldn't like to leave it as long to make another film, but I got reminded of that. Is that why you don't do them a lot? Because they are quite involved. But we'll do a little bit of television this year, and you know, I think if something involves writing.
Yeah.
I do. You know, someone said to me 8 years ago, at the end of the day, it's what you write. And I sort of think it's possibly true for me anyway. It's. I don't think I'd be satisfied if it didn't require some form of writing.
Thank you so much.
Hey, pleasure. Nice to meet you.
You too.